So as I was milling about tonight, I was talking to a lot of people who are your fans, and I think they'll be even bigger fans after they've finished reading your book, for the reason that I was, which is I was completely struck by your candor. Is there anything about this book, at any point that you felt that you had to hold back? Anything that you weren't going to share? Not that you probably would share it now, but...
Yeah, I'm trying to. Now am I supposed to share it?
I do have, as you will attest, I play it for laughs, but I have a fairly... I have a pretty candid section on infertility, which is the number one reason that people, families who adopt sites, is what led them to explore adoption. And I do play it for laughs. But people have said to me, it's a little hard to hear our program after reading that section.
Describe the magazines and the whole process.
Because you walk into, and I'm sure nobody here has had this experience, but you walk into a fairly squalid little room, no matter what kind of concessions they try and make to make it habitable, and you're given a stack of magazines that make Playboy look like The Economist. And there are videos there, and all of the interesting. John should mention the Studs Terkel Award, because all of them seem to have in the title the words either, forgive me, whips, nymphs, chains, or studs, and not Studs Terkel. And you wonder where were these when I was a teenager, and then they give you the little plastic cup, and of course I think I've described in the book that I just lay back and think of England.
Of course you did.
And, whatever works. And my first time when I was leaving, I said to the nurse, I filled a couple of cups just in case you need extra. And she sighed and said, every man makes that joke. I'm glad that technology is available. Interestingly, the biologist who was responsible for engineering that, Cambridge University, physician, medical researcher, just won the Nobel for that technology, and his name is Bob Edwards. And I sent an email to the other Bob Edwards and said, "Boy, that's amazing how you've such a virtuoso." In any event, I'm glad that's available, but it was after a couple of rounds that my wife and I said, "Look, this is expensive and it's building up, and." For the money that we've just put down a lab test tube, we know there are millions of children in the world who already exist and who need families, and we sure need them, so why don't we adopt?
How did your coverage, or how did your world experience, for those of you who don't know, you adopted two girls from China, they're now 4 and 6, how did you decide on China? I mean, there had to have been, from your experience, there had to have been so much thought that went into it.
Well, there's a lot of thought. I mean, that go into how you're going to adopt and from where. The fact is, adoption is, as I may not have to mention to some people, but I hope I detail it a little bit in the book. Adoption can be intimidating and daunting, and it's not easy. A lot of the reasons I respect, you certainly want to prevent the worst kind of people from adopting children. But all of that being said, I think increasingly there has been layers that are meant to protect the children and wind up not protecting children, because I think every child deserves to have a loving family, at least one loving parent, and the clock is ticking. And when adoption takes years, and children are institutionalized or in foster families where that can't be finalized, I think there's something irreplaceable that's lost. We looked at domestic adoption programs, and for a variety of reasons, we would have been at the back of the line. And then we began to look overseas. We looked at some places where I had some experience as a reporter, like Bosnia and Ethiopia. And at that point, those programs, there was a very long wait. China said that from the moment you were approved for adoption, you could have a child in your arms within 9 months, and that sounded very good to us. And I must say, since we'd been trying to start a family for 2 years, you look for signs. And there are some people here who know us. And, my wife and I guess were married after 8 days. So we didn't have a lot of time to talk about everything. But interestingly, we did we did talk about adoption as something that we would want to do. And when we met and fell in love, or at least I fell in love with my wife, certainly, she lived on Mott Street in Chinatown in New York. And we said, oh boy, well that was meant to be then, wasn't it? Because you look for signs. Nowadays, that the waiting list for China is between 4 and 6 years, I think we would have said, Chinatown is right next to Little Italy, so maybe we should look in Italy. But in any event, there were a lot of factors that led us to the Chinese program. It was the most expeditious running at the time.
I want to go specifically to the title of your book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other. And at what point do you really know that you're meant for each other when you have a complete and utter stranger that you're holding? And you write very candidly in your book, but you're joking, but I'm sure there was truth to this. Our daughter hated us from that first moment because
it wasn't a joke. It was significantly different with our second daughter, in part because of the presence of our oldest daughter. But I think this is common for you. You were told when you adopt a child that frequently you don't expect a Hallmark moment when they're placed in your arms, because their attitude is not, oh, you are the parent for whom I have been longing. Thank you so much. It is so good to be with you. No, they have been torn away from the only world that they know. Elise, our oldest daughter, had awakened that morning in an orphanage. She was bundled up. She was taken in a long van ride, and towards the end of the afternoon, she was thrust into the arms of strangers, and who held her and kissed her and sang to her and cooed to her in a way that she had never experienced. It's up there. I don't have to point to this. That was taken, I guess, 3.5 days after we got Elise. So you can see that attitude does not persist forever. But the first couple of nights are absolutely rough. I mean, Elise cried so much. Her little cheeks were so red, blistering really. I thought the tears would sizzle. And our trip coordinator, Shigu, knocked on the door and said, how are things going? And we said, oh, great, great, Shigu. And he said, well, you should go downstairs and get something to eat. And I remember going downstairs to get something to eat, and we looked at the other families, four other families who'd been with us at the time. We all received our daughters at the same time, and we all lifted the glass to each other because they were having just about as good a time as we were. I just don't write about our family's experience, but there have vignettes of 12 other families. And Steve Levitt, the University of Chicago Freakonomics professor, and he and his wife have two little girls who happen to be adopted too. Steve says something I think that's very wise in there, where he says, children certainly are absorbent and remember a lot of things, and they also have a genius for forgetting what they don't need to survive to the next day. And I think within 2 or 3 days, they refer to this as bonding or attachment. I think Elise had begun the process of attaching herself to us, felt that we were responsible for her for the foreseeable future. And that's where you see that that wonderful smile, actually both of the smiles. I think I say in the book that I have made my wife smile upon occasion, but I've never made her smile like that, not even once. And
Lose conviction in those 3 days? I mean, 3 days is not a long time, but in a circumstance like that, 3 days is a very long time.
Well, I wouldn't say lose conviction, but absolutely you wonder if you're doing the right thing. My wife and I didn't vocalize that, but we admitted later that what I did say to her is, you know, our daughter hates us. And sort of laughed at that. And we surrounded her in the bed. We were always holding and kissing her. And her Chinese name, which is now part of her middle name, is Feng Xiaomei. From the township of Feng, and then GMA, excellent, beautiful. And so we would surround her and we would chant because we wanted her to know we were on her side. Feng Xiaomei, Feng Xiaomei, Feng Xiaomei. Totally unmoved her. And now she likes it. She thinks that's really neat. So it's a, my wife has a wonderful phrase for it where she talks about not the extraordinary bond of adoption, but the extraordinary bond by adoption. That adoption itself is the act that that helps bring you together, helps knit you together as a family. And I have really grown to believe, this is the way we started our family, so I don't know the others except having been a son for a long time myself at this point. But I really do believe that in those families who are blessed by adoption, and I know some folks here tonight are from those families, we are inspired to say things out loud to each other that I think sometimes are assumed in Abraham and Sarah, traditional biblical begetting style families. You know, oh, you're my kid, of course I love you. Or, yeah, come on, you're my father. Yeah, of course I love you. Well, we actually do vocalize these things. We're inspired to say these things and not kind of leave it unexamined or unexpressed.
I find it also interesting, you talk about the issue of race, and how did you consider it? And sort of as context, you say that anybody who says race is never a factor, it's really not the truth. I mean, race has got to be a factor for everybody. And then you have this horrible description of a man who was handed a child who he considered was too dark and sent it back.
Well, I mean, we'll never know the full story of this because I think there is another story, which my wife and I just theorized. This was a man who we saw from a distance when Elise was coming into our lives in China. And it should be said that he already had two daughters from China. And he said that he was there by himself. As I said, his wife couldn't make the trip. And he said he wouldn't accept the third because the daughter had a dark complexion and just she wouldn't fit into the family. I think it's possible, as my wife suggested, and here's the scenario, the narrative we constructed. Maybe he knew that family was splitting up. Maybe he didn't think it was such a good idea to add another daughter. And he said the single most reprehensible thing that he could, that the Chinese adoption officials couldn't avoid and had to say, okay, you could, because they tried to convince him for a while, and then he came out with this reprehensible statement. And so they kept the entire fee, and it was absolutely hideous. I don't know the full story. I mean, the fact that he had two daughters who were already adopted from China suggests to me that something else was going on, and I don't know. My answer on some of those questions, I think, has grown sharper even since the tour, since I've been touring with this book in September, because, on the one hand, race is singular and immutable, and you wouldn't want to say otherwise, yet, I mean, we are an interracial family. My wife and I like to point out that statistically we're even almost a majority Chinese family. And children are so many other things before you notice their ethnicity. They're hungry, they're tired, they're thirsty, they're funny, they're agitated. We always know they're Chinese, and yet weeks and months go by when we don't think about it. And I must say, I think people who get hung up about that sort of thing, firstly, we are growing up in such a significantly different and better country. And I point immediately to that other Chicago family that's in the White House, which is an interracial family in addition to being an African American family. And these artificial divisions, I really think it's the way small minds keep score, but these artificial divisions are getting clouded even more by the fact that we are mixing and matching in so many different combinations. I mean, when my parents married in the early 1950s, they were considered a mixed marriage, Irish, Catholic, and Jews. I don't know, would people consider that a mixed marriage now? I don't think so. I just think we see a lot of different combinations. And I also, I don't mind saying I resent people that see only our daughter's skin color, that think they have to be identified by that, because they are so much more than that. I mean, their skin color is great, their ethnicity is great. But on the other hand, they are so many things besides ethnicity. And I don't like people who refer to them as our Chinese daughters. I mean, you don't want to jump all over somebody who means only to be nice. But all of that being said, they're our daughters, and yes, they happen to be Chinese.
My last question before we move on to discuss your work, I was also really struck by...
This isn't work?
Your other work.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
That not being able to conceive a child still hurts.
Well, I think I'm over it now. But I write in the section on infertility, it absolutely hurt at the time. Because you feel that you have, failed the person you love most in the world. That at some chromosomal level, you're not living up to, what everybody from eunuchs to Buddhist monks, to Lubavitchers, agree we were put on this earth to do, which is to keep creation going, you know, add to the species. And you feel that you have failed the person you love most in the world in that regard. But, you know, I, not being ethereal about it, or too ethereal, I should say, I can see that there was some larger purpose in mind. And for one reason or another, that just wasn't, that wasn't going to be in our futures. And, I mean, now I'm kind of happy because I love the daughter. I'm very happy. I'm delighted. I'm giddy because I love the daughters that we have. And they wouldn't be in our lives unless we had to go through that first. So I'm delighted with the way things turn out.
Are you going to say something inappropriate tonight that'll take you from being an NPR reporter into a $2 million contract with Fox News? What do you make of the whole Juan Williams dismissal?
I welcome the opportunity to avoid that question, Jared.
You won't get it.
You ask it of, in addition to all else, let me put it this way. I have expressed my thoughts to executives at NPR, and holding nothing back. And I think I probably shouldn't express them here. I think, you know, there ought to be a chance. There is an investigation that's going on by law firm to, I think the public has a right to know how the decision was reached and to be assured that there was no kind of outside pressure, either from contributors or from interest groups that contributed to it. And you know, I think that that'll be a free and fair investigation. I don't want to totally squirrel out on it, though, in the sense that, you know, Juan was on our show a lot. He is a good friend. He is a good personal friend. He joins our family and his wife, Delise, a lot. And he is not a bigot. This is the author of Eye on the Prize. He is not a bigot. And we wouldn't have our daughters crawling all over his lap if he was a bigot. So let me just give that kind of personal note of support to Juan. And I'm happy for him. I mean, he's got a son at Haverford. He can he can use the extra income. Yeah. And I said to him, you know, we'll always be friends, Juan, and that's true.
Going forward, what's happened with the media landscape? How much room do you see for objective journalism?
Well, I hope what we do illustrates what NPR does, illustrates each and every day the room for the need for objective journalism, because I think it's important. And one of the things, to maybe say too much, that strikes off Juan's termination, one of the many regrets I have is that NPR gets played off against somehow being the counter to Fox News, which I don't think is true. I'm uncomfortable with that definition. If in a market sense there's a counter to Fox News, it's MSNBC. NPR has no counter in the market sense. We are a news organization. And one of the things that I think a news organization has to do, and I hope we do it one way or another every week, is to challenge the preconceptions of our audience. By the way, we have a significantly larger audience than either Fox News or MSNBC, and 20 times the audience that something like CNN has at this particular point, I think in part because there are still tens of millions of Americans who want that kind of, who want a real news organization. But a real news organization will sometimes do stories that will upset you. You will notice that news organizations that become identified with one ideology or another, or even one party or another, are always pandering to their audiences. You know, they're always criticizing the other party. They're always lauding politicians of another. You know, and I guess in this circumstance, I was one of the anchors of our election night coverage, and I made a point of switching around a bit before I signed on. On Fox News, there was this, I think, completely inappropriate partisan triumph and crowing about the results that seemed to be building, at least in the House of Representatives across the country. And on MSNBC, there was, in its own way, it's I think, equally offensive refusal to accept reality. And, you know, I mean, we're we're different. That's not what we do. And I welcome the opportunity to do stories which sometimes bring our audience, our listeners, up short and make them see something new. A number of years ago, we did a story. There was a proposed gun control ordinance, or strengthening the gun control ordinances in the state of Maryland. And to this day, I think the most articulate, eloquent opponents of gun control I've ever interviewed were residents of the inner city of Baltimore. And they would say to me, well, maybe when you folks in Georgetown call the police, they come there in 2 minutes, but they never come here. And what you call a cheap Saturday night special, that's our home security system. And when you tell me, oh, don't you realize statistics hold that if you have a gun in your household, the statistics suggest it'll be used on a family member, not an intruder, they say, you let me worry about that. You let me protect my family. And firstly, I understood why the ordinance was defeated. And I rather enjoyed the consternation of a lot of our listeners who were very angry, who had, I don't mind saying it, racially profiled folks in the inner city of Baltimore because they assumed they shared their convictions about gun control. They had to, right? They lived in the inner city of Baltimore. And I was so glad we did that story. And I've said to our staff, this is what real journalism is. You have to do stories that every now and then will really upset your audience in a creative way. I mean, I don't want to offend them with obscenity. I don't want to. There has to be a point, and I think stories like that are absolutely worth doing because it introduces people to another aspect of the story. You know, which is why, for example, when I read people who are labeled as opinion columnists, I really welcome those most who surprise you. I think that's what makes them worth reading, because if you always know they're going to massage your preconceptions, why are you reading them? I think there's something pathetic about that.
The darker side to all of this is, of course, you know, we understand that there are financial motivations. There's a reason that Fox is very successful, that they have the ratings, so they bring in the money, and there's a reason now that CNN is shifting its programming so it can be more like Fox, the same with MSNBC. Obviously, they're very different financial mechanisms between NPR and those commercial entities. But how right now is any sort of financial awareness not seeping into NPR or at least lurking there that you're aware of it?
Well, because we have an audience that's much higher than theirs. 30 million people a week listen to NPR programming, and I think in part because we surprise them. And in part because we're not just pandering to them, but we really give them information and features and interviews that really can't be found anywhere else. And we don't pander. At least I hope that's the market argument that we create for what we do at the same time.
And how do you also keep, and we get this question all the time as well, how do you keep yourselves in check? Because the media is a very insulated world. We all know each other. We all sort of travel in the same circles.
Well, you and I just met tonight.
Yeah, right, we go back to 20 minutes ago. Yeah. But
I know Emily Rooney, though.
Do you know Emily Rooney?
You've worked for Emily Rooney for 12 years.
I have worked for her for 12 years.
Not a lot of people can say that.
I have the T-shirt. I survived Emily Rooney. Yeah. I shouldn't say that, but this is being recorded.
No.
Talked me. Is that my $2 million contract?
John's
right there?
Back there. John's back there going.
Sure. So, how do you keep yourselves in check?
You know, I don't find that a problem. I am chromosomally talking about my chromosomes a lot tonight. Chromosomally, I'm a journalist at this point. I welcome the opportunity to sometimes aggravate prevailing opinion. I think that's what journalists do. I also, you know, there is no more compromising experience in the world, by the way, than to be a real reporter. And this is something that I sometimes tell people who are covering their first political beat. And I remember when I covered the Chicago City Council, and I would meet, I don't mind saying, some independent liberal reformers, and I found them just at a personal level to be insufferable. Just personally, they were too full of themselves. Not all of them, but some of them were. And on the other hand, I would meet these old acolytes of the Daily Machine who some of whom would wind up being indicted and convicted, and I just found at a personal level, they were very nice. And I liked them. And one of the vignettes in this book is about Eddie Burke, the dean of the Chicago City Council, who I like a lot. He and his wife have 5 children who are adopted of different ethnic backgrounds, as a matter of fact. And you learn that, that there's no kind of correlation. And so as I covered the Chicago City Council, I would see people who I liked and knew indicted, and I felt sorry for them and their families. And I would see people who I thought I shared a lot of convictions with, and I wasn't happy if they prospered, because I found that just added to their insufferability. And this is what happens when you really cover something and leave yourself open to learning things and recognizing the human factor in all relationships, and not just seeing people as cups that are filled up with an ideology, but as real flesh and blood human beings who have a variety and a range of emotions and experiences, and for that matter, convictions in their lives. So I think, with some exceptions, I find it difficult. I don't mind saying I felt very strongly about Bosnia, and it showed. I feel very strongly about gay rights, and it shows. And I guess I feel very strongly about adoption, and it shows. But the range of things I really care so much about that I kind of want to cross that fine line are really very small.
I'm wondering how it is about the way that you work that I was struck in one article I pulled about you. It went from talking about your interview with Dame Edna to you being shot at in sniper fire, under sniper fire in Sarajevo. How do you cross all those boundaries? And I get asked that question a little bit too, because I cover the arts and I also cover politics, which in the end is really all theater. But yeah. What is it about
your... Did you see Whitey Bulger in the lobby, by the way?
I didn't. I've been on the lookout for Whitey Bulger for a long time.
He comes here for the hors d'oeuvres and then just disappears, doesn't he?
I was once told that he used to come here to Boston and he would walk around in a nun's habit and walk around Castle Island.
I've heard that story. Yeah. Is that true?
So it must be true if we both heard it.
Yeah, yeah, I'd say so. Anyone else hear that? Because if we get 3, we can say it's true.
So I used to run in Castle Island, because I lived near there, and yeah. I would look at every... I'm saying too much already, but... a lot of them look like...
A lot of them look like Whitey Bulger?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you cannot save that. No. You cannot save this recording. Do you realize what kind of lawsuit that's going to invite from the Archdiocese?
So I am just wondering how it is about your approach that it can fundamentally work the same, to be in that both of those circumstances.
That's what I enjoy about what I do. Interviewing Dame Edna, Barry Humphreys, the actor who has portrayed Dame Edna for years, but interviewing him as Dame Edna. Can I tell a parenthetical story?
Of course.
About that?
Yeah.
I don't think he'd mind. We wanted to interview Barry Humphreys as Barry Humphreys, who's had an extraordinary career, was part of the Beyond the Fringe group in London at Cambridge. He was in the original cast of Oliver. A lot of people don't know that. And then, of course, created Dame Edna, and he has another character, the Australian cultural attaché, Rod McKenzie. A lot of vomit jokes. Very good, very good barf jokes. And we wanted to interview him about his entire... And he's a very accomplished landscape painter, too. And we wanted to interview him about all of that, and he suffered a death in his immediate family. And his public relations people called up and said, look, he's still going to do the tour. He needs to work. He needs to get back out there. But he doesn't want to talk about his life. He doesn't want to talk about being Barry Humphreys. He wants just to be Dame Edna. I said, fine. So that's why we, because ordinarily we wouldn't do an interview like that, but it was just wonderful. That's what I like about it. I like going back and forth. I mean, I like being a part of a very serious story that I care very deeply about. Cared very deeply about in Sarajevo, but I also like doing the Barry Humphreys, and if I did just one kind of story, I think I would feel that I was threading myself into the ground, and I like to think that my touch with serious stories is maybe a little refreshed, because I'm not doing them all the time, because I am doing the so-called funny stuff. And at the same time, I hope that maybe when I do something that's funny or feature-ish or even just for laughs, that there might be a different note in that too, because I do have a somewhat different approach.
Well, and it's actually a coup to interview, a journalistic coup to interview Dame Edna, because she does so much research about you that it can be very disarming. She digs up, I've done it too, and she digs up things that you don't even remember about yourself, and you think, how did she figure that out?
Yeah.
But I think I'm getting the wrap, so we have time for Q&A now, and I just have to remind you, because this is on the WGBH's forum network, anything you'll say, like the stupid things that I said earlier, will be broadcast to Emily Rooney and everybody else in the world. It does get posted online, so just be aware that if you do ask a question, it will be recorded by the forum network.
My next book, I have no chance whatsoever of being on Emily's show, do I? After that, okay, yeah.
Right here.
Daniel Shore.
Cy Hirsch.
I didn't know Cy Hirsch.
Oh, well, he's still alive.
Cy Hirsch is still alive. Well, you know, I'm sorry. Of course I know Cy Hirsch. I'm sorry. I was thinking of someone else entirely. Yes, I know Cy Hirsch. I know him through Dan Shore. And Cy actually worked for the City News Bureau of Chicago years before I came along in Chicago journalism. And I only know him socially. I've certainly read his stories. Dan, I know really well. And, I think I'm probably just beginning to kind of get hold of his death. That happens to someone you're very close. I mean, there was the memorial service, I spoke at that, and then went off with my family on vacation, and then came back, and I've had this book tour, and I think I'm just... particularly when the election week struck, I'm just getting hold of the fact that, he's not there at the office anymore. Family gave me his typewriter. I have Dan in mind when I talk about what real journalism does. Certainly he made a lot of people angry for one reason or another, and for good reasons. And he absolutely had the audacity to challenge his audience. You know, we didn't... I'm working on obituaries. We prepare obituaries in advance for people of note in our business. And I'm preparing a couple of obituaries now for people who are in their 70s and 80s in one case, which is kind of when you do it. We didn't begin to prepare an obituary for Dan until he turned 90. And just because it had never occurred to us that... why would we want to do that? And it's a little awkward to prepare an obituary for someone who has the office next door to you. So we had to put another slug on it. And it also had to be someone whose obituary I might plausibly do. So for some reason, we settled on Buddy Hackett, the Bronx comedian. Dan was born in the Bronx. And for those of you who heard the obit, we interviewed now the late William Sapphire, who was a devoted friend of Dan's, and Mike Wallace. I'll never forget Robert Siegel walking by the board, and he looked at him and said, "You're interviewing Bill Sapphire about Buddy Hackett?" And so a couple of years ago, my wife and I had been out of an evening, and we were listening to the news in the kitchen as we came back, and we heard the hourly newscast and heard that in the summer of his years, at the age of 83, Buddy Hackett had been taken from us so suddenly. He died at the age of 83. And I leapt on the phone and called the newsroom and said, "Don't touch that obit." I was scared that they would say, "Oh, this is great. We have a Buddy Hackett obit. We'll put it on Morning Edition." And I think what really still distinguishes Dan, what's worth remembering, everything's worth remembering, he never stopped being hungry. He loved being on the air. He loved the news business. He didn't get by on autopilot. He was never jaded. He always thought that there was something new to learn, something new to be discovered, something new to turn over. And it was to combine Dan and my children in one anecdote. Dan and Lee, and these tea parties continue, but Dan and Lee would have tea parties with our daughters. And there was a couple from the West Coast who had been visiting and announced that they were crashing the tea party. No political
significance. Todd Palin.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And in any event, I wasn't there. It was a Friday afternoon, and Dan came home, and so they really just showed up. And so Lee prepares this beautiful formal tea, and Dan was telling me the next day, he was amused by Elise, who was then six, because when Lee moved the formal tea server, the silver tray where you have the sandwiches and little petit four and all that sort of stuff, moved it from the end of the table that Elise and Dan were sitting at down to the other end of the table so the visitors from California could get to it, Elise said, "Hello, some of us are still hungry down here." And Dan loved telling that story. And I think it was because he really identified with her. He died just days short of being 94, and he never, he was still hungry. You know, he still wanted to do more, and I think that's great.
Question right here.
I used to enjoy this Studs Terkel's columns, a real true curmudgeon. Could you say a few words about Studs?
Well, I knew Studs all of my life, literally. He was a friend of my father's. Truly a singular, absolutely a singular character. And I'm afraid a lot of the stories that are flashing through my mind I can't tell you because they have extremely profane punchlines. I can't tell a clean one. I'm trying.
That part comes later.
Studs in Run Garden. I literally can't tell a.
That was Studs.
Yeah, that was Studs, absolutely. And in any event, I think his great, among the many things that could be learned from him, is he has a great capacity to talk to anybody. And when I was talking before about how you shouldn't just see people ideologically, but see them in full, I think one of the things that was often overlooked in Studs' career, he did a series of interviews with people who were convicted in the Watergate scandal, which are extraordinary. I mean, with John Dean, with Jeb Stuart Magruder, some of the names are escaping me at the moment. And Studs interviewed them, I mean, in real time. It was I forget what the legal dispensation of most of the cases were at that point, but it was going on in the 70s. I was hearing this a number of years ago, and we were preparing some kind of tribute. And it was absolutely extraordinary, because I certainly knew what Studs' personal convictions were on all of that. But he treated them with absolute humanity and respect, and because of that, got them to open up and talk about themselves and their lives. I think there's a great lesson there in those interviews that he did.
It's when his daughters become adults, what concern does he have for them as being adoptees?
I think you mentioned neurobiology, which reminds me I'm in Cambridge. there's no easy answer to that, except I think that, you want to be open to everything. I want to be open, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And sometimes a hissy fit is just a hissy fit. A tantrum is just a tantrum and has nothing to do with adoption. Although a number of the people we talked to in the book, Vignettes, Martin Simon, the son of the late Paul Simon, senator from Illinois, says it was always wonderful growing up that he could attribute everything to adoption. He said it spared him all the other adolescent anxieties and traumas because he could actually trace everything back to adoption. And he said, it was wonderful to kind of have that to fall back on. I think for youngsters who've been institutionalized, as our two little girls were, there can be what are sometimes referred to as triggers. Hunger can be a trigger. They go through periods where, if they're hungry, they don't say to themselves logically, we have four flavors of premium ice cream in the freezer, every yogurt stick ever invented, cookies, baby carrots, celery. This is what our kitchen looks like. They say, "I'm hungry," and they become more agitated because something kicks in neurobiologically that reminds them of when they weren't fed when they were hungry. And this can persist. And I say in the book that my wife and I have learned, and this is probably not bad advice under any circumstance, you have to be, I think I can use a baseball analogy in Boston, you have to be a little bit like a manager and know when to pull the pitcher. In other words, you don't wait for something to go wrong. A good manager will not say, well, everything seems fine, I'll let him keep pitching. They say, nope, he's thrown 100 pitches, he's got to get out of there before something happens. Whereas my wife and I have learned, we can't say, well, everything seems fine, why don't we just, you know, let our girls stay until they have a tantrum because they're hungry or agitated. So I think you learn little things like that. And I also think you, I don't think this is advice, if I may presume, having been a father for 7.5 years at this point, if I might presume to give advice about being a parent to anybody, I think this is probably a good thing for all of us to remember that, our children will reflect a lot of things and we have to be open to reflecting things that, to them, evincing things that don't reflect us. One of the things that I think some people who are, have given a lot of counseling to people who are families who are blessed by adoption will say, you know, it'll be the temptation of you and your wife to, if the girls, your daughters, evince artistic talents, to trace it to, oh, well, that's just like Aunt B, who used to play my Aunt Lou, rather, used to play the harp at Marshall Fields. If they evince musical talents, oh, just like Aunt Lou. Is to not expect them to kind of necessarily ratify our traits, to be open to, you know, recognizing traits that have nothing to do with our family experience, much less lineage. But I think that's probably good advice for everybody. And, you know, as my wife and I say, we, you know, if our little girls want to be accountants, we would welcome that. I mean, somebody's got to keep the rest of us out of trouble. And I think a lot of that kind of advice is probably good. And I look, and I also, I do you have some background in neurobiology?
No, I'm just interested in
literature. You know, I think one thing you can never remind yourself about enough as a parent is this is an actual human being who's in your life. And all of the literature is interesting, and you should, you know, read as much as possible. You know, but in the end, it's been my experience that you tend to, you know, there's some books you agree with and you keep rereading them, and the ones you don't agree with, you just let collect dust. So it tends to be rather self-serving advice anyway. In the end, you have to be sensitive to your own child, the real living human, you know, being who is in front of you, and not just abstruse advice, which may or may not have any particular pertinence that you can recognize to the actual child in your lives. And I get back to what I said before. I mean, I absolutely don't think that adoption should be considered a trauma. And it should not be considered a trauma to get over. It is not. It is a blessing. It is something to be treasured. Jeff Seller, the Broadway producer who grew up, he was adopted by a family in suburban Detroit, and he and his partner Josh have now adopted two youngsters. As he says, look, we within a few years we all get something, and by the time we're in our adolescence, we have a lot of stuff that we think of that we have to get over. We stumble, you know, we get bruised, we fall down, we have to get back up, and every reverse we have, we recover from it, and we get better from it, and that's how we go on in life. And as he said, look, I suppose, he said, look, adoption's a tough way to start life, no doubt about it, or being relinquished by your birth mother, being deprived of that intimacy and primacy of contact is tough. He says, look, if you're determined to never get over that, you can do that. But why would you want to do that when life is, you know, is so much, you know, richer? And I mean, I relate to that. I mean, I'm the son of an alcoholic. I could go to Al-Anon meetings for the rest of my life, couldn't I? But why would I want to clot up a Thursday night that way? And, you know, I mean, I think they're good for people who need them at a certain time. But we all have something in our lives. And I really do resist the idea to cast adoption as some kind of trauma to get over, because it's not. It is a blessing that enriches millions of lives, and it should be enjoyed and appreciated for what it is.
I think we have time for one last question, and Chica will bring the microphone over.
Oh, I'm sorry. Back to the news, if you'll indulge. It seems that so much of what passes for responsible journalism is almost interviewing provocative people on one end of the extreme and then on the other, and the listener is left to swing like a dangle more, like a pendulum between the two. And some of the moments that I treasure most about Weekend Edition are when Scott Simon, often at the end of a show, says, "I want to talk to you." It's an editorial that I often find very moving and certainly stimulating and thoughtful. There aren't enough of them for my... How do you decide when and on what topics that you weigh in that way?
You know, there's no one answer to that. It depends on what else is on the show, what else is in the news that week. I have a feeling that I shouldn't be serious, with the exception of something like the weeks following 9/11. I shouldn't be serious. I can be serious 2 weeks in a row, but I shouldn't be serious 3 weeks in a row. I can probably be funny. I probably shouldn't be funny 2 weeks in a row. I look for stories that maybe otherwise there'd be no attention paid to it. Then on the other hand, like the week of the Chilean miners, there's some stories that are so overwhelming you have to pay attention to it. So it's amorphous, and I mean it's something that goes on in my head all week. And rarely do I have an idea on Monday that survives until Saturday.
Well, Scott, thank you so much.
Can I make a report?
Yes. In addition to the fact that Scott will be signing his books over there, he has a book.
I've been fortunate enough to bring our daughters and my wife along on some of the stops I've made, and I regret that they're not here because we really do love being in Boston, but there are a lot of circumstances that just made this... made the Sunday and Monday impossible. In any event, when I'm not with them, I ask people to sign this little orange book for them. So if some of you wouldn't mind just writing something to Elise and Lena, a little something to our daughters, we like to read them when we get back. Okay, nothing profane. Dan, can I trust you, Uncle Dan? All right. All right. Thank you very much.
Scott Simon, thank you so much.